ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When Professor Gordon Wallace of the University of Wollongong started in the materials science field 35 years ago, he thought somebody else would already be working out how to make new materials and manufactured related structures. But turns out there was no one meeting the needs he envisaged, so he thought why not, and he began researching and doing it himself. From the 1990s, advances in material science became basically a new way of thinking about what could be done, what could be manufactured. Indeed, the term revolution is not too strong a word to describe the progress made. This is a remarkable story. The science has led us into a world of almost miraculous science fiction, creating replacement body parts, think about it, produced via 3D printing, along with hopes of methods and materials aiming to see quadriplegics walk again, schizophrenics, and maybe even people suffering Parkinson's becoming conditions of historical curiosity. There are many, many areas this research might go in. And there's a new strand to 3D printing. It's called 3D bioprinting, involving the use of living cells. Gordon's the director of the Intelligent Polymer Research Institute at the University of Wollongong. He's an internationally renowned researcher in the field of electromaterial science and a man with several research projects on the go. So we're going to zero in on a couple of them, namely the cartilage project, which involves a quest to 3D bioprint living ears. I kid you not. I know. Gordon, good evening to you, and welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, good evening. Great to be here.
It's terrific to have you with us too, and what an exciting field. Also joining us tonight is Associate Professor Payal Mukherjee. Payal is one of Sydney's leading ear, nose and throat surgeons and the surgical innovation lead at RPA's Institute of Academic Surgery, where she's been working on the cartilage aspects of printing living ears. Payal, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me.
It's terrific to have you with us. We're also thrilled that briefly joining us as well to discuss the cartilage project and also other issues as well is one of Australia's great living treasures, Fiona Wood, a name known to many of you as well because of her naming as Australian of the Year back in 2005. She's got an Order of Australia, a National Living Treasure. She's the director of the Burn Injury Research Unit at the University of Western Australia, famous, of course, for spray on skin. She's also been working alongside Gordon's research team on skin regeneration. Fiona Wood, good evening to you.
Oh, good evening.
It's terrific to have all of you with us. Gordon, can we start with you first? These advances in 3D printing, and put them in context for us. When we talk about 3D printing, we're not talking about those machines that hobbyists buy from electronics stores, are we?
Well, I mean, they can do 3D printing of very basic materials.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically building structures from the ground up, layer by layer, that they do certainly fall under that umbrella. Of course, those very cheap printers can do fairly cheap materials. As you get into more sophisticated 3D printing, where we can print metals and we can print ceramics and more sophisticated polymers, the price gets...
Just explain what that means. When you say you print metals,
yep.
What does that actually mean? Because a 3D printer, the ones that you've seen in the hobby stores, I just want people to get a handle on this if they can, basically lay down thin layers of resin,
yep,
until they build up a shape.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the metal printers are fascinating.
What are they doing? Laying down? How do you lay down a thin layer of metal?
So you put down a very thin layer of a metal powder, and then a laser comes over and sinters that layer by layer. Then you put down another layer build it up. Fascinating to watch. 3D metal printing is really an exciting development.
Okay, so you're using finely granulated metal powders,
yep,
then basically melting them as, yep, you go with a laser.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can do ceramics where you can print the ceramics as part of a polymer formulation.
And the laser bakes it in between?
No, then you just bake that, just heat treat that afterwards to form the ceramic structure. All of those different types of printers, of course, get very sophisticated.
So it's a bit, it's still mud pie making, isn't it, at a very sophisticated level?
With very high resolution,
yeah,
and very sophisticated. And of course, the structures that you can create are quite extraordinary. I mean, not just the shape, but think about varying the internal structure when you're 3D printing anything, whether it's a polymer, a metal, or a ceramic. You can manufacture things that you just cannot do by conventional manufacturing.
So just, okay, I think I'm getting a handle on this. The 3D part of it means is that because the computer can make a 3D model of the object and it can lay that those materials down to conform with that model which someone's loaded into the machine.
Yes, that's exactly right. And as I say, it's not just the shape, but it's the internal structure as well that you can have infinite variations and control over to create very sophisticated internal and external structures. So that's conventional 3D printing. Now, 3D bioprinting takes us to a new level because now we're looking at can we introduce living cells into those 3D printed structures?
And how would you do that?
And, well, you would have the cells as part of the what we would call a bioink.
So you would spray the cells down?
No, you would imagine an ink in a printer, in a cartridge, and that ink has got cells in it, and there's also a biomaterial within that, usually a biopolymer, which will suspend the cells within the ink, so as we get a nice distribution for the print. That biopolymer has a number of roles, keeps the cells dispersed, protects the cells during the printing, and then provides the right environment after printing so that the cells can develop in an appropriate way.
So it's like spraying cells in a kind of agar gel, is it? I mean, I'm...
Yeah, but not spraying, but... Laying them down in a very, with really exquisite control over where we put the cells and where we put the materials.
So what's spraying the cells? A very fine spray nozzle?
Yeah, I mean, you can use an inkjet printer to create 3D structures. So, you know, you can build things up by inkjet or by extrusion printing.
Okay, so you're laying down the cells essentially in a medium which will allow the cells to grow.
Yep.
Which will also hold the shape that you're trying to create.
Yes.
And then you take that object that you've created away, and is it alive?
It's living. It's got living cells in it.
But whether it stays alive is another matter.
Well, the secret to keeping it alive in many of our applications is then to integrate it with biology. So, for example, if we're trying to look at skin regeneration to take that 3D printed structure and create it, where we need it to integrate with biology and facilitate that regeneration. So it is a living system in that the cells are alive. But, you know, the requirements...
Have you done this or are we thinking about it?
No, this has been done. This is done on a daily basis in terms of creating these types of structures. The real breakthrough was in the discovery of the materials that could form the bioinks. Because that number of criteria I explained to you, you know, here's a material that keeps the cells in suspension, protects them during printing, where they're under extreme pressure and extreme stress, and then creates the biological environment for them to perform.
But that medium, that's right, doesn't disappear. It stays there, does it?
Some of them will disappear. Yeah. So some will disappear with time, and others will stay there. It depends on the application as to how long they would be around for. But their job is to make sure that the cells are integrated with the biological system and perform their biological function in vivo.
In theory, so you could print a human hand? In theory.
Eventually somewhere down the track, I'm sure. There are limitations as to what we can do. I mean, when this field first emerged, there was talk about printing whole organs.
There was, wasn't there?
And that's quite complex. I mean, I tell you, the real challenge, or the first challenge is, you know, as you get bigger and bigger, then you need a vascular system to grow through that 3D printed structure in order to support the biological function. And there are some strategies that are helping us to do that. And we're getting closer to do it. But there's so many steps along the way where we can take the technologies now and just integrate them with biology and let biological regenerate, just facilitate it, you know, rather than try and create.
Fiona, can we bring you in here? This is Fiona Wood, Professor Fiona Wood, Director of the Burn Service of WA. And I think everyone has heard of Fiona Wood's great work and the spray on skin and so on. Fiona, you're very interested in this for obvious reasons, but Skin, I'm suspecting you're going to say to me, skin is really complicated, isn't it? it's not just a thin layer of cells that you spray on, is it? Tell me how complicated the piece of skin is.
Well, I think we can look at it from many different ways. I think we talk about it, the waterproof outer layer and the sort of inner layer that's tough and gives that sort of resistance and wear and tear. But there's the hair follicles, the sweat glands. The skin intimately involved with the nervous system. I mean, why do we blush and things like that?
Yeah.
Temperature regulation, immune responses. So it is. Oh God, I could talk to you about skin until you turn to dust. It's so complicated.
when we talk about skin, Fiona, are we talking about we're talking about a discrete tissue which starts somewhere and ends somewhere. It's not as though it just merges into the muscles and fibres of our, say, for example, I'm looking at my arm, it's actually a thing, isn't it, with a top and a bottom.
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's the largest organ in the body, as you could imagine, because it covers such a big surface area. And it's got all cells from... when you start with that sort of very small, the egg and the embryo, we have three sets of cells, the outside, the inside, and the middle.
Mm.
And all those cells are represented in the skin. And so when Gordon was just saying we need a blood supply, we need a nervous, the nerves in there as well.
Yeah.
We need not just the sort of waterproof cells and the sort of tough cells that are producing the framework for the skin, which is mainly collagen, but we need all those other aspects as well. And so when you start to think about the 3D printing, we've been spraying skin cells on since the early 1990s. But can we spray the cells on with materials that self-assemble so that then they guide the cells in situ? So we're printing in our experimental work actually into wounds. Mm. And so we're printing at the point, the idea is at the point of care, and then the cells will be guided by the frameworks that we've printed so that they'll produce and regenerate skin. Mm. So it is very exciting.
So spray on skin is essentially what? This is a whole much more simplified thing. Really, is you're essentially spraying skin cells, with the top layer, is it? Which will just create a covering in a sense.
Well, the main two layers, think of it like a bread and butter sandwich,
mm-hmm.
and we peel the bread and butter sandwich apart, and the butter is the sort of the engine room, if you like, where mm-hmm. a lot of cells. Turning over and replacing the surface of our skin all the time. So that's our target zone. They're the primary target cells that we harvest and then we spray back on. But that just only takes us so far. What we want to move forward with is the whole skin structure.
Okay.
The framework, the printing self-assembling frameworks on there so that the cells are in an environment where they think, whoa, I know what I'm supposed to do here. And they produce skin as opposed to scar.
Wow. We're talking with Professor Fiona Wood here. We're also in the studio with me is Professor Gordon Wallace from the University of Wollongong and Associate Professor Pyle Mukherjee. Pyle, I haven't forgotten about you. We'll get you to shortly, but I do know that Fiona has got to scoot in a moment, so I just want to pick her brains about this just before she has to go. But Fiona, so this you're collaborating with Gordon's team at the University of Wollongong. How far have you got?
Well, we've done a lot of work on the bench and in models that we're using, and I think that we move in towards very closely now to thinking about, can we do our first human trials? Because we've done a lot of work in this space, and I would put 2025 we'll be doing this in the human.
So you've produced on the bench. You've produced on the bench a piece of living human skin from top to bottom. Print.
Well, yes, it's possible, absolutely. But that was done a little while ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's been much more, like Gordon said, that's much more sophisticated now. And we've taken it into more sophisticated models. And then the next step is our first human work, which is all really on target, I think, for next year.
Extraordinary. It is extraordinary. If you've, you might have questions, 1-300-800-222 if you'd like to ask one. 1-300-800-222. We're talking about advances in the world of 3D printing and bioprinting as a means of actually manufacturing. That's the way to think about it, isn't it, Gordon? We're manufacturing human tissue here.
Yes, and certainly facilitating that process. In the case of the skin, as Fiona said, we're actually manufacturing in vivo, in situ. So we're encouraging the manufacture, fabrication, regeneration of skin.
How long does it take to produce a piece of skin, a centimetre by a centimetre?
Fiona, can I answer that?
My apologies. Sorry, I think what we're doing is actually printing skin into the wound.
Yeah. Right.
So we've moved away from trying to grow a piece of skin in a tissue culture flask or on the bench, mm-hmm. and then transferring it to the wound. What I think is really exciting about this is that we've kept the capability of printing directly into the wound in surgery. So the shape of the wound and the sort of the uneven surfaces and all those things can be taken care of, because historically we take skin grafts, which are sort of pretty two-dimensional, and we've grown skin sheets many years ago, but then they have to be fixed into the wound. And of course, there's the time in the laboratory. What we've been really driving hard for is to actually do this at the bedside. And so we don't. So when you ask how long does it take to grow a square centimetre, it depends on the wound of the person and there's so many factors. But we need to really get it healed within a week. That's the goal. And certainly we're looking like we're very close to that. 7 to 10 days.
Wow. It sounds like a complete game changer. Is it, Gordon, really?
I think so. We work with a number of clinicians in different areas, and it's really just changed the way we think about treating some of these challenges. The fact that you can arrange materials and cells in three dimensions with exquisite control over where they are just changes the way you think about those treatments. And as Fiona said, if we can do that in situ, basically with a handheld printer to print directly into the wound, that takes it to another level.
That's what I was going to ask, Fiona, because I'm thinking there must be some giant machine hovering over the wound. Is there or not? Is it, as Gordon says, a handheld printer? What is it?
Well, we've been working in a whole range of printers and so you can have a very big robotic type printer, but certainly I think the handheld is much more that we have that's in development now and in use is much more flexible, and it sort of feels comfortable in your hand. So it's from a surgical perspective, it's not such a big leap. It's like, oh yeah, it feels that it's a natural progression.
How these machines, Fiona, are we set up to manufacture these machines, or where do they come from, or do you build them?
Well, I bounce that straight back to Gordon. I'm the clinical side of the fence here.
Yeah, so we design and build the printing technologies, and that will be one of the manufacturing opportunities of the future, is providing those printing technologies into the clinics around the world, I think.
Yeah. Just in terms of human health costs and so on, how would it fit within the current health framework, these ideas? I mean, are they stupendously difficult, complex and expensive procedures, even though we can do them?
I can comment on the hardware and the materials. No, they're not. They're clever devices, but they're certainly not expensive devices, and the materials are processed in a way that they're not particularly expensive. Processing the cells has an expense. And Fiona could comment on the other expenses in terms of the surgical deployment, but in terms of those engineering aspects, it's not expensive.
Mm. So, yeah, just one final thing to you, Fiona, because I know you have to go, but in terms of patient outcomes and so on, what difference does this mean? What improvements does this make?
I think when we're doing this, it's always got to be the focus on improvement. Mm. And the improvement has got to be at every level, at the patient level, the quality of the outcome from the team delivering the care, so the clinical manageability, and then it's got to be integrated into the system, so it's got to be affordable. So when we're developing these things, we're looking at every level of a very complex system to make sure that we're not driving down the wrong rabbit hole. So it's got to improve outcome. It's got to be able to be handled, to be taught, to be used. And of course, I think the opportunity to manufacture the handheld printers here in Australia, would be just fantastic. Because we can harvest the cells. We've developed the systems for harvesting the cells, and that's been in commercial space for 20 years now. Mm-hmm. So we've been on this path, I guess, doggedly, certainly from my perspective, for some decades, but always with looking at what's coming over the horizon, looking at that new technology, and then making it work within our system. Mm. And that's the key to this.
Okay. In your opinion, this is the future of skin grafting?
In my opinion, yes. I think skin grafting was first done in the late 1800s. It's worked very well for a very long period of time, and I'm sure it'll work very well into the future. But the future is regeneration and trying to heal the skin without scarring. Mm. And so, therefore, this technology gives us an opportunity that a skin graft doesn't.
Quite incredible. Fiona, I'll let you go, but I really appreciate your time. I know others have loved hearing
you
from you. Thank you, and thank you for your work. Professor Fiona Woods with us about the future of skin grafting. It's pretty exciting, Gordon, isn't it? Really?
It is, and it's amazing to work with clinicians like Fiona, who are so skilled, of course, in their surgical skills, but so committed to developing the next technologies for their patients.
What's the manufacturing capacity like in Australia to make these things on any scale?
I think we do have the capacity.
Oh. We can make these things.
Yeah, we can make them. I mean, there are different types of machines, but they have to be made, of course, under more tight regulatory conditions than some of the printing machines we could make at the moment. But we have the capacity to do it. Mm. And we have the capacity to generate and process the materials. And as Fiona said, to generate and process the cells as well.
Mm. Okay, let's talk to Ross from Epping. Ross, good evening to you.
Hi, I'd like the professor to comment on where we're at replacement cartilage in knees.
Ah, excellent. That's an excellent question, Ross. I was just about to ask him the same question. Listen up. Gordon, tell us about cartilage.
Yeah, sure. So we do have a cartilage program underway. For the cartilage in knees, it's headed up by Professor Peter Chung at St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne, and Pale will talk to us about cartilage in ears. Where we are with that at the moment is that we've identified the materials and cell combinations that we want to use. We have looked at some preclinical trials. We're looking at an extensive preclinical trial in the next couple of months, and we're planning our first in-human trial next year. So that has really progressed. That's been a slow burn. We started that project a while ago, but we really see that the doorway to deployment coming there.
Cartilage sounds like an easier thing to do, doesn't it, than skin?
Yeah, I mean,
because it is the same sort of cells. Really.
Yeah, it is, but I wouldn't tell Professor Peter Chung that. but it is. I mean, you got one cell type and one material in this case.
Yeah.
We still have to distribute them. We still have to process and get the right combination. But yeah, you don't have that multi-layered structure, particularly for the defect in the knee. It is really a rather simple challenge for 3D bioprinting, or one of the simplest. There's still some challenges around it.
But you could lay down the the 3D printed cartilage into the knee in situ, as it were.
No, well, in fact, what we're doing is similar to what Fiona described, and that is that we're one of the approaches is just to print a combination of materials and stem cells into the knee in the right arrangement and to regenerate the cartilage in the defect. And this is where we're going with a lot of our applications, the regenerate at point of care, as Fiona was saying.
I'm going to get to Pyle very shortly, Pyle Mukherjee, the ear, nose and throat surgeon, because here's the thing. How about the concept of 3D printing an ear? I know they are working on this. Just back on collagen, just before we talk to Pyle about this. So the idea if a person had, for example, needed some knee reconstruction, you could print the damaged cartilage into the knee as the patient lay on the table.
So what we envisage is that we are going to regenerate the cartilage in the knee. Our target is in one surgical procedure that we would harvest the bioactive component, for example, the adipose or fat stem cells from behind the knee, process those, create the bioink in surgery and print into the defect, and then regenerate cartilage on site in vivo in the knee.
Quite extraordinary.
and again, that project also, we've had to build a customized biopen. It seems that most surgeons are pretty keen on doing their own bioprinting, even though we do have a robotic option. And we often joke that the ideal pen for the surgeon, is, and Fiona sort of alluded to it, is a biopen with one button on it. I guess two is a bit complicated.
Well, let's try and bring some others into this program because it is completely fascinating.
ABC Radio. You're listening to Nightlife.
Nightlife with Philip Clark.
Yes, if you've just joined us, we're talking about advances in the world of 3D printing, 3D bioprinting, printing human tissue. We've talked to Fiona Wood, Professor Fiona Wood from Western Australia, about printing human skin. It's being done, and it's not very far away, Professor Wood thinks, from applications to human wounds. We've got in the studio with us Professor Gordon Wallace from the University of Wollongong, who's Director of the Intelligent Polymer Research Institute. We've also got Professor Pyle Mukherjee, who's an ear, nose and throat surgeon and surgical innovation lead at RPA. She's working on a cartilage project to, listen to this, 3D print living human ears. Pyle, how does this happen?
Well, believe it or not, when Gordon and I started collaborating on this a long time ago, I was really interested in applying this technology, precision medicine, to the field of ear surgery. And we said, well, let's start with something easy. Let's start with the outer ear because it's big. You know, we can't really, you know, I couldn't fathom the concept of 3D printing an ossicle. Was I wrong? It is 3D printing cartilage is actually quite difficult. We've come a really long way, and it really, it's not just a matter of us working in a team with, you know, Gordon's fabulous team, but it's also collaborating with the other clinicians like Peter Chung, like Fiona Wood, and learning the lessons, the strengths and challenges of each body site, even for the same tissue type. We're doing really well with the 3D printed ear project, but even now going into potentially 3D printing a human ossicle using metal 3D printing that you first touched on.
You better translate this for us for those who are not in the medical field.
Oh, a human ossicle, human hearing bone, which is about 5 to 6 millimeters.
Is that the
size.
Hammer, the anvil, or the stirrup?
Oh, we are very good. We're working on the anvil.
On the anvil, okay.
Yeah. The reason to mention that is because when Gordon mentioned 3D printed metal, each person's hearing bone is unique. And as hearing surgeons, we find it very difficult to get good results. Our results would be so much better if you could apply precise technology. This sort of these sort of solutions are just not feasible without 3D printing. And then we, you know, bring it back to complicate that by introducing stem cells and cartilage cells. It gets very exciting, but it is complex.
Yeah, I love it when you say it's complex. Pyle, I think it's about the most complex thing I've done an interview about for many years. So get my head around this. So when you're talking about printing a human ear, you're talking about not the earlobe, but the hearing mechanism of a human ear. That's from the eardrum all the way to the cochlea.
Well, that's my, you know, when you have a pie in the sky vision, that's my pie in the sky vision. But the thing, one of the things Gordon alluded to was tissue types are different. So if you want to achieve success, you want to break it off into separate sub-projects. So the first project when we were looking at the human living ear was to 3D print the cartilage of the outer ear, which of course doesn't have the function of hearing, but it does have a huge role in for children, particularly for their cosmesis, but also helps them wear a hearing aid or helps them wear glasses.
You're talking about the ear lobe itself, are you?
The whole ear.
The whole ear.
Yeah. Not just the whole ear, yeah. The pinna,
when I say you've got big ears, I mean I'm talking about what you've got.
The bit of the ear that you can see. And, you know, the most of that ear is cartilage and skin, and then just down the bottom is, you know, a bit of fat, which is the earlobe. But the ear is actually unique to every person, and I just, for some miracle, your left ear is identical to your right ear, but your left ear is very different to somebody else's left ear. And so one of the most common congenital malformations in the head and neck is a condition called microtia, where the ear doesn't form. And for the most common presentation of this is that only one side is affected. So we have a 3D image of the other side, and we can actually precisely plan an anatomical model that at the moment the best solution is to, in 3D printing, is to 3D print a custom non-absorbing ear, so it's quite solid and quite hard. But, you know, in the last 6 years, that's been a giant leap in microtia reconstruction, so we don't have to harvest rib cartilage of children, and we can actually get them rehabilitated quite early. But with the 3D printed living ear, you know, we want that living ear not to have, you know, not to be hard as rock. We want it to emulate the qualities of an ear, that it is elastic, that it has strength, that it doesn't, you know, rupture, doesn't get infected. So it's amazing how challenging it is to actually reconstruct the outer ear.
Gordon, tell me about the use of seaweed for cartilage.
The seaweed extracts that we're using at the moment could have application in cartilage regeneration, but also in skin regeneration. So there are biomolecules in seaweed, from brown seaweed. There's a molecule called alginate. It's just basically a big biopolymer, high molecular weight, and in a green seaweed called ulvan. And the alginates have been used for some time in bioprinting, and we're using them in some of our projects. And the ulvan is a relatively newcomer on the scene, which we discovered here in Australia, how useful that was for skin regeneration, in partnership with the seaweed farmer who works about an hour drive from here down south.
Really?
But quite an exquisite seaweed farmer.
A seaweed farmer on the coast of New South Wales?
Yes. But she's a biologist, the PhD in biology, Dr. Pia Winberg down the coast. And Pia and I entered into a collaboration to identify some of these molecules and now to actually use her farming techniques to produce these molecules in a very reproducible way. So usually these molecules would be used in food additives, for example. So, you know, real critical control over how they're produced wasn't all that necessary. But when you're going to put them into your 3D bioprinter, which is going to create a structure which goes into your human, then we need exquisite quality control in the farming, the harvesting, the processing. It's an exciting collaboration, a brand new industry.
Extraordinary. Professor Gordon Wallace with us. Professor Mpal Mukherjee is with us as well. If you'd like to ask a question of these extraordinary scientists, 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. Nick from Carrara. Sorry, Nick, you've been waiting on there. Hello. Hi, Nick.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Not bad. Sorry, you've been waiting on there. What's your question?
Yeah, so my question is, anything that's biologically printed, does it have nerve endings or would it just be numb?
So for some applications, we would facilitate nerve growth through the structure. So some might have nerve cells or progenitor cells, stem cells that would turn into nerves. It depends on the application. Others would be naturally infiltrated by the nervous system after implantation. But it is possible to print structures with nerve cells or the progenitor cells, the stem cells that would develop into nerves.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks, Nick. Paul, if you're making an ear, with the earlobe itself, does it need to be sentient, as it were? Not, that's the wrong word. But it could be a numb ear, couldn't it, as long as it's alive?
Yeah. I mean, usually the sensation comes from the skin on top. Mm. So when this is reconstructed, the idea is to use whatever remnant natural skin is, and you do skin graft on top of the framework, which is the living cartilage that you put in. It is numb, but then we do expect the more of the natural skin you preserve, the more sensation there is of the ear.
Mm. How far is this? I mean, I asked Fiona Wood about skin, which appears to be a very long way along the road. How far along the road are you with the ear, do you reckon?
So we're piggybacking on some of the benefits that we've had in the findings of the knee cartilage. So ours is well into animal trials, and we do anticipate, you know, sometime in the future to be in clinical trials. There are other groups around the world that has started, they're tinkering with clinical trials. There's certainly been... it's definitely a space to watch. It's not that far away.
Mm. So you don't see any particular technological or theoretical hurdle you've got to overcome here. It's just a matter of refining it, do you think? Is it? Is that what we're talking about?
I think we've come a long way. There's numerous technological hurdles. I mean, it's one thing to get the science right, but it's another thing to scale it with quality control in human beings. So I think that just to get the science right is not enough. And a huge part of this collaborative work is to actually understand the cost effectiveness of the technology. How can you set up manufacturing that, you know, when we're dealing with, human tissue that does not necessarily behave like metal does? There's a huge amount of variation. How do you make sure that what is being printed and implanted is exactly the same when there's such a huge variability? So I think all of those channel challenges is the phase that we're thinking about at the moment, and it's really important that we work collaboratively because we'll all have the same translational hurdles. So I think there are still some hurdles that we've got to knock over, but I think the fact that we're doing it together and there's such a huge collaborative group of experts will mean that we'll get there faster.
Mm. You're saying the research community in Australia is pretty integrated then, are you?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, and, you know, kudos to people like Gordon. I it's amazing how he has the skill of, don't tell him I told you this.
He can't hear a thing.
Of course. he has a tremendous ability of, you know, bringing communities together, and we all benefit from his leadership.
Mm. Well, it is amazing. 1-300-800-222. We're talking about the world of 3D bioprinting. Gordon, you said that, because some years ago we used to talk, didn't we, about printing human organs, printing human hearts, for example.
Yeah.
Or printing, even though you might, I'm not being naive about this, you might think a relatively simple organ like a kidney, for example. I know it's not simple. Did it turn out to be not so simple at all when you tried to do it?
Yeah, it's not so simple, and we've never tried to do that directly. Others have, but when you're talking...
With any great success?
No, not that I'm aware of. I think people have done small, really small, basically replicas, but once you try to scale things, that's when it gets pretty difficult. But look, we'll get there. You know, everything we're learning about how to integrate 3D bioprinted structures with biological systems teaches us about how to build systems to get better vascular distribution, et cetera, and so to build much more complex and bigger organs. So we'll get there. I just don't think we probably won't get there in my lifetime, but I wouldn't say never, because, I mean, if someone had have asked me 10 years ago, would we be doing today what we're doing with Fiona and Pale and Peter Chung and others, I probably would have just shook my head, but we have. Things have happened that we didn't anticipate.
Tell me about the complete cornea. This is this is an exciting project.
It is.
In your lab, you have hand-assembled a complete cornea.
Yeah, so we've been working
That's
with...
part of the eye, by the way.
Yeah, so it's the transparent window to the eye, as they call it, and we've been working with a consortium, again, as Pale mentioned, the importance of this collaboration, consortium of... research partners from a number of universities and the Sydney Eye Hospital, and with our lead clinician, Professor Jared Sutton. And we have created, so it's a bit like skin, we've got those three layers, and we've been able to get those three layers and basically bioglue them together. But let me tell you about a real challenge in the cornea, though. The stroma is the middle layer, and the stroma is composed of individual layers of collagen, hundreds of them. And if you took one of those layers and looked at it, it's composed of aligned collagen fibrils, right? And every alternate layer is arranged at right angles. And that's what gives it the transparency and the mechanical properties. How on earth did that come to be? And now we have this challenge. How can we replicate that and bioengineer it? Well, it turns out that we can, but we've had to do it by hand at the moment.
I would have thought that's something that's very soluble with robotics, isn't it? Isn't that what robots do?
But just even creating that aligned structure of the fibrils, a very fine layer of collagen with all of those fibrils aligned, it's not obvious how you would do that, but you know you can do it. And now our challenge, having handmade that with our consortium partners on the bench, is to build a manufacturing line which will do it through robotics and will produce multiple cornea.
Because there's a big shortage of corneas in the world, isn't there?
There is. I think it's 1 in 70 on the waiting list globally that we're able to service. I should mention a really critical partner in this is the Organ Tissue Donation Service in New South Wales. So we get a donated cornea. We take the original cells from that donated cornea, and through processing and through introducing the collagen molecules, we can generate 30 bioengineered cornea. That's the target. So,
wow.
But of course, working with them is important, not only in sourcing the materials in the cells, but in retrospect, this is a no-brainer, right? I mean, that's what these guys do for a business. They're set up to package and deploy and get those things out into the clinic. And so that's a really exciting, but what I would call a non-technical collaboration, which is making a huge difference in the bioengineered cornea space.
Philip Clark with you. This is Nightlife. We're talking about the world of 3D bioprinting. On ABC Radio. This you say, is about getting to the next stage, which is scaling up the manufacturing. And this is where, every single time Australia has developed something fine and creative and extraordinary, like you have, this is the hurdle we seem to fall over at. We can't ever seem to scale it up. We invented the world's most efficient, you know, solar panels. Couldn't scale them; they all went to China, and that's that. You know, that horse has bolted. What do you think the outlook is here for with the cornea project, for example, setting up a manufacturing capacity for this?
I think we can do this, and I think
you need capital, don't you?
Oh yeah, we will need investment, but the critical thing is that we have the team and the skills and the commitment of that team to do it. I think you mentioned in the introduction that when we started in this game some decades ago, the whole idea was you would get the handmade bioengineered cornea, and that's where you'd stop. Mm. You'd say that, right, let's publish that in Science or Nature. This is great.
That's right.
But now everybody knows that we have the responsibility to make sure that manufacturing happens. Mm. It's not somebody else's responsibility. It's the responsibility of the researchers, the clinicians, everybody involved in the team to make it happen.
David from Gaimea. G'day, David.
Hello. How are you, Philip?
Pretty good. Amazing story, hey?
It's driving me wild. It's great.
I know. It's astonishing.
So the question I had was, they were talking about, technology for children, putting an ear on and whatever, and their living tissues, do they grow
pile? Do the ears that you grow?
Not in size, but in texture. So what we do is we print the size that we want, but then we put cartilage cells, so chondrocytes, in the ear, we get it to be as mature as possible, and then we implant it, and then the tissue stays and grows and regenerates as the structure of the scaffold will slowly disappear, and therefore then you will develop the cartilage will grow to be a living, breathing, flexible human ear.
Yeah, but I mean, does that mean the child needs a bigger ear as it gets older?
No, so that's what I was saying, not in size. So even at the moment when microtia reconstruction's done, usually a child's ear is sort of adult size, between around 8 to 10. Now with the 3D printed, the non-bionic ear that we're doing, we can now operate on children as young as 4. But what we do is we just size the ear up when we implant it. So that's the ear that they'll have for their life. Mm. But we want to get the children done before school so they don't have time out of school and things like that. And the beauty of this, I mean, I do this with a colleague of mine, Joe Dusseldorf, even though the current ear is not living, but it's setting up the healthcare the model of care. Because what I will do, I'm an implanting surgeon, so we try and coordinate the care delivery. So whilst the reconstruction's being done, I'll get in there and I'll do the hearing implant placement all at the same time. So sometimes these kids who are coming in from interstate, they don't even know that this extra bit of the operation's being done. So there's no extra wound, there's no extra cuts. And it allows us to also engage the patient community to know, so the parents, we hold annual symposiums to sort of let them know, make them aware of the current technology, but also the future technology. And we bring the patients along in the journey. So whatever we're designing for the future actually has patient input in it.
Mm. Professor Pahal Mukherjee, leading ear, nose and throat surgeon, working on these 3D bioprinted ear projects. David, I hope that answers your question. What else? Richard from Melbourne's got a question too. G'day, Richard.
Hey, thank you. Everything you print needs arteries and veins and perhaps the lymph system to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Does the printing system print little tubes with arteries and veins?
Gordon?
For applications where that's required, yes. Sometimes we will rely on the printed system to be infiltrated once it's implanted. With those, but certainly that's an ongoing area of research, is how we get those vascular systems to grow throughout the structures.
Mm. Amazing. How does all of this this may be a stupid question because I don't understand the science. How does this interact with the excitement some years ago about stem cells, that we could grow cells? Of course, stem cells are foundational cells which can turn into all sorts of different tissues, nerve, blood, skin, organ tissues, etc. How does what you're doing intersect with that research?
Really piggybacks on a lot of those advances. If you take the cartilage regeneration in the knee, there had been a therapy using stem cells, just injected into the knee with no biomaterial. There had also been an alternative strategy where it's just the biomaterial used. When Peter Chung first approached us around 3D bioprinting, he said, well, both of these things have their limitations, but it seems like they can help each other. And so really we're piggybacking on a lot of those stem cell technologies and developments, combining it with 3D bioprinting.
Because you can be bioprinting three yep. stem cells.
Yes, which is exactly what, you know, is some of the things that we're doing for some of the applications.
Wow.
So we're learning a lot from each other. Those communities are learning a lot from each other and how to better use cell therapies or how better to deliver cell therapies.
Mm. Does everyone know about this, Gordon?
Yeah.
Do governments know about this? I mean, do venture capitalists know about this?
Yes, and I think it's reaching a stage. It's an exciting juncture, right? Mm. I mean, because as you've heard from Fiona, looking at the first in human in a very short period of time with the skin, cartilage first in human next year, the bioengineered cornea, the components of that that'll get into the first in human in 2 or 3 years' time. And it's once you've got those things happening, that's, of course, when the investors get really excited.
Mm.
So we've still got a hurdle to jump over, but we've got the team together here in Australia. We're in a very fortunate position. You mentioned it before about we do have an integrated research community, integrated researchers, integrated not just with researchers, but clinicians, regulators, those involved in policy development, all coming together. You know, we're small enough and innovative enough to do this as a team, and I think that puts us in a very strong position.
Fantastic. It really is very, very exciting. Payal Mukherjee, what you say has blown our minds, as it were, and certainly we've got our ears open to continue the mixing up of puns, but I do thank you for your time this evening. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Gordon, look, more power to your arm and to your machinery. And thanks so much for telling us about it. It's a very exciting piece of Australian research.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good on you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.